Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University in cooperation with the Goethe Institute Boston and the American Council on Germany. Tonight's discussion is titled Being Muslim in Germany Today and features authors Nechla Kalek and Peter Schneider. Our moderator is New York Times correspondent Steve Kinzer. We begin with an introduction by Institute Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome. We have the event entitled Being Muslim in Germany Today. This event is taking place as part of a series of events organized by the Goethe Institute entitled Being Muslim, Being Jewish in Germany Today, Prospects for a Pluralistic German Society. The conference explored the issue of integration of Muslim population in populations in European societies in various countries, and this is also going to be the topic of today's interventions centered on Germany. The two speakers, Nechla Kalek and Peter Schneider, are distinguished authors and public intellectuals. They will be introduced by equally distinguished author, Stephen Kinzer, who will moderate today's discussion. Stephen Kinzer is the New York Times correspondent and author of Crescent and Star, Turkey Between Two Worlds, and All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. Throughout his career, he covered more than 50 countries on four continents. He's a veteran foreign correspondent. In 1996, he became the first New York Times bureau chief in Istanbul. He spent many years working and living in Turkey, writing about Turkey's drive to join the European Union and other very important issues. He has reported on political trials and on his own arrest by Turkish soldiers when he was trying to understand Turkish army's campaign against Kurdish guerrillas. Prior to his arrival in Istanbul, Mr. Kinzer covered, among other topics, German unification, the war in the former Yugoslavia, and the emergence of post-communist state. From 1983 to 1990, while the Sandinista government was in power in Nicaragua, he was the Times bureau chief there. We look forward to Stephen Kinzer's newest book, titled, I Believe, Regime Change, Why Americans Overthrew 15 Governments from Hawaii to Iraq. Am I right? This is the good title?
You're close enough.
So thank you very much, and please continue.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back here. That was supposed to be before. I was supposed to thank you after that, I guess. It's great to be back here at Boston University, which is actually my alma mater. We're in the Photonics Center, and I've been promised that if I do a good job moderating, somebody afterwards is actually going to tell me what photonics is. In the meantime, we're discussing a subject that I think is going to be more and more important in the years to come. And it's a subject that interested me more and more during my years, first in Germany and then in Turkey. I was living in Berlin when I got the news that I was going to be sent to Turkey and become the first New York Times bureau chief in Istanbul. Now, living in Berlin, you can get the feeling that you know something about Turkey because there's a large Turkish community in Istanbul. And like most people who live in Berlin, I was under the impression that I did see a little bit of Turkey around me. There are 1,000 Turkish restaurants in Berlin, for example, and I got to know Turkish cuisine, which is made up of rice and kebabs, as far as I could understand. Imagine my shock when I arrived in Istanbul and found that Turkish cuisine is one of the richest cuisines in the world. It doesn't have anything to do with rice or kebabs. It has influences from Greece and Armenia and the Arabs and Central Asia and the Caucasus. I realized then that my idea of Turkish cuisine was completely mistaken. The idea that I had of that cuisine in Germany is nothing like the real thing. A similar experience happened as I got to know Turkish society. There are many, many Turks. There are millions of Turks living in Germany and quite a large community in Berlin. So I was hanging around in Kreuzberg and other parts of Berlin where there are a lot of Turks. And through them, I got to understand what Turks are. people that come from a poorer country. They live in small villages. They're very closed in on themselves and really not so connected to the outside world. Imagine my shock when I arrived in Istanbul to find the quality of the intellectual elite as high as it is in Germany or any other country in the world. These are such worldly and sophisticated and educated people, and it drives them nuts that the image of Turkey in Europe is shaped by these poor villagers who would be completely lost in Ankara, much less in Köln or Berlin. So my arrival in Turkey was full of surprises. They were almost all interesting. But while I was living in this wonderful modern environment, it did have one shock. I got to know a guy who was a sociologist in Turkey, and he had done work in Turkish prisons. He told me that in the hierarchy of prisoners, the thieves are looked down on the most. All the other prisoners hate them, whereas the murderers are quite respected. Everybody likes them in the prison, just the opposite of what you would expect. And when I asked him why this is, he explained to me, murderers here in Turkey are not like murderers back in Germany or in America. They're not people that jumped up on someone in a dark alley and tried to rob him and then shot him in the head. That doesn't happen here. We don't have those kind of crimes in Turkey. A murderer in Turkey is usually somebody who has killed in defense of family honor. And this is considered something very positive and something to be admired. So I found this quite shocking. Here was a culture that is just as foreign in Istanbul as it is in Germany. That is the traditional culture of rural Turkey finding its way into the big city. So these are reminders that Turkey and the countries around it are in a position of great change, and Turkey is really leading this. Turkey is going to be the first country in this part of the world that is going to try to embrace and adopt European values. Now, our first speaker, Necla Kelek, is very much immersed in this issue. Her new book is Die Fremde Braut. It hasn't yet been translated into English, unfortunately. It means the foreign bride or the bride from outside. It's quite a moving book. Das hat mich zum tief geschüttet eigentlich. It shocked me as well as moved me. It tells a story about Turks in Germany that many of us don't know, and I think that some of us didn't want to know. But I greatly admire Necla because she's done what I always wanted to do as a journalist. She reminds me why I wanted to be a journalist in the first place, which is to be the voice of those who have no voice, to tell the stories that otherwise would not be heard. This is what her book does. This is what she's doing, and this is what she's going to share with us tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, I was born as a Muslim because my father was a Muslim. I was also socialized as a Muslim, but I am not here as a representative of Islam. However, I will talk about Islam because my field of research is the politics of this religion. I am delighted to be here as a freelance author and social scientist and talk to you about the worries and problems of a group of women that usually does not have a lobby, namely Muslim and Turkish women who live in Germany. Earlier this year, I published a book with the title is Die Fremde Braut, the Foreign Bride. It is about my family, which came to Germany from Anatolia via Istanbul, and it describes my own road to freedom. It is an account of Turkish women whose families marry them in arranged marriage to a man in Germany. The dowry is Germany, but they remain foreigners in a foreign world and are often kept like slaves. The book tries to discover the reasons why the integration of my compatriots from Turkey into German society and culture fails over and over again. I wrote this book to change this. during my research, I talked to dozens of women who are called import gelin in Turkish, which means imported brides. They all came to Germany hoping that their lives could only get better. The typical imported bride is usually not older than 18 and comes from a village in Anatolia where in 4 or 6 years of schooling she has learning barely how to read and write. Her parents marry her to a man of Turkish origin who is unknown to her but to whom she might be related. After the wedding, according to the law for uniting families, she arrives in Germany, into a Turkish family in a German town. She lives exclusively within the family and has no contact to people outside of the Turkish community. She neither knows the town nor the country she lives in. She does not speak any German, does not know her rights or to whom she can turn to if she is in difficulties. For the first months, she is completely dependent on the new strange family because she does not yet have a residency permit. She has to do whatever her husband and her mother-in-law demand of her. Otherwise, her husband could send her back to Turkey, and that would be tantamount to a death sentence in the social and real sense. Soon she will have 2 or 3 children. Without children, she is worth nothing and could be expelled from the family. Children will tie her to the host for years. Since she knows nothing about German culture, she will bring up her children as she has seen it in Turkey. She will talk Turkish to her child and will raise it according to Islamic tradition, in the same way as she had been raised. She will live in Germany but will never have arrived there. About 2 million Turks live in Germany, and about 200,000 to 300,000 Turks have taken German citizenship. Half of these 2 million have already assimilated or are about to assimilate. The other half withdraws into their Turkish communities, into their Turkish Islamic world. They live in end of Germany, but not with Germans. About half of them are women. Every second woman lives in an arranged marriage. Between 15 and 20,000 new spouses come to Germany every year because of the law allowing families to be united. Until someone proves me wrong, I claim that out of this number, every second marriage was also arranged or even enforced. Marriage, yes or no, there is no question about that in Muslim society. Wedlock is considered the only acceptable way of life. It is not considered a sacrament in Islam, but constitutes a civil law contract between two families. I do not see a major difference between an arranged marriage and one that is enforced. The results are the same. One speaks of an arranged marriage when the girl or the boy has the possibility to refuse the partner chosen by the parents. In forced marriage, the partners are married unasked or against their will. Embarrassed, silence or quiet crying on the part of the girl are considered as consent. Girls are shy. Both forms of marriage are far removed from a free decision. By now, every democratic party agrees that enforced marriage should be prohibited. There are even initiatives for banning it as a criminal act. I welcome that, but I think that exclusive concentration on enforced marriage misses the heart of the problem. I believe that in Germany, every woman and man, no matter of which religion or ethnicity, should have the right to decide on her or his own when, whom, and particularly whether she or he wants to marry. From my research, it appears that the integration policy does not fail primarily because of the financial situation in many Turkish families. Yet there is no doubt that much needs to change. There are well scenes. One in every four Turks is unemployed. And unemployed man separates from and hinders participation in the life of a society. Moreover, integration does not just fail because of a lack of education. Still, it is a scandal which concerns everyone that 4 out of 10 Turkish kids leave school without a degree. They are the future welfare recipients. But the reasons for the failing integration policy lie deeper. When examining Islam, one has to ask a very important question. What is our basic idea of man? I want to take up this question because that is how we get to the core of the matter, namely why integration fails over and over again. By now, the majority of Turks in Germany has to be counted among Muslims, and their concept of life and their everyday culture are strongly influenced by Islam. There is something that I would call Turkish Muslim common sense. In German, you could call it Leitkultur. Islam is a collective identity, even what it is not lived in a religious sense. Islam determines the worldview and the idea of man of the Turkish Muslims. In our German democracy, freedom, the rights and responsibilities of the individual and his or her protection by and against the state are central. In Muslim communities, however, the ummah, that is the community, is most important. It determines what the individual has to do and what not. Muslim communities are collectives, the family, the clan, the ummah. Every member of this collective community has to take responsibility for his or her acts before the family, the community, and before God. Vice versa. This means that the community makes decisions for the individual. He or she is protected and told what to do. The individual is not independent, but only part of a large whole whose laws and prescriptions are ultimately God's will. This worldview is pre-enlightenment and makes people passive. As a result, the brides uncomplainingly endure their fate, and therefore young men in extreme cases virtually feel obligated to kill their own sisters if they have violated the laws of the ummah. This worldview and concept of human order are not questioned but are taken for granted. Certainly not questioned by Muslim for whom Islam as a religion of law is God-given, but not even by Christians who seek the dialogues with Muslims. A dialogue requires acceptance of the other, whatever he or she is like. Islam means dedication to God, and a Muslim is a person who bows to God's will. Yet this dedication cannot be achieved by prayers alone, but only by an entire way of life. Its values, however, like the way children are brought up and married, the exclusion of women from participation in public life, absolute obedience towards old people, the refusal of self-determination, all these values that shape the lives of a large part of the Islam migrants in Germany are incompatibly with democracy. People who, for religious reasons, marry their 16-year-old daughter are not interested in her education. Those who demand of their children only dedication to God will not urge to them to think independently. Those who only expect respect, meaning obedience, have not interest in democracy and self-determination. Those who believe that in the name of honor there is a right to exert violence violate a basic principle of democracy, the separation of powers. How can someone we cannot even choose a partner to marry a son responsibility for him or herself and for society? Therefore, we must not only seek a dialogue with Islam, but confrontation and discussion. We have to defend actively our democratic values, our constitution, and human rights, and must not accept that in the name of Islam they are withheld from a large group of people, especially women. It is wrong that the platform of the German-Turkish Forum of the CDU party calls for giving these basic values of culture and Islam equal status with the constitution. Either the author do not know better or they misunderstand the high value of tolerance, basic values of culture, as they are lived by the majority of Muslims. Conflict with the constitution, especially with the principle of equality for men or women. In my opinion, the protection of foreign cultures ends when human rights are not guaranteed to everybody but it man or woman. We have to learn more about this Muslim pluralist society right in our minds in Germany. We have to know what is being taught in the Quran schools. We have to know what the Hodjas preach in the mosques. We have to know why they are not interested in contact with Germans, why they often do not send their children to school, why they do not allow their doctors participation in PE, sports, and school trips, why girls wear a headscarf. We have to learn more about their values, attitudes, and motifs. We have to take a close look and to come up with a lot of ideas about how to get the Muslims out of the ghetto, of the powerless society, and how we can demand of them an active participation in integration. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nejla Kelek. Soon after I found out in a telephone call that I actually received on my home on Cape Cod one summer many years ago that I was going to be sent to Germany as a correspondent, I started reading what I could about Germany. And one of the first books that was recommended to me was a book about escapees who wanted to jump over the Berlin Wall. So I found this book. The Mauerspringer, it's called in German, the wall jumper. And I was looking forward to a book that would explain to me the oppression of East German society and why the East Germans are so eager to escape from this tyranny and come to live in the freedom of West Berlin. Imagine my shock when I read that this is actually a book about somebody in West Germany who wants to jump over the wall and go to the East. That was when I first realized that Peter Schneider must be a very interesting, what they call in German, a Querdenker, a guy that thinks differently from other people. And the more I read about him, read of his work, not just literary, but also his commentaries in German newspapers, the more I felt that I had found a kindred soul. Peter Schneider really is one of the most outstanding journalists in Germany, and he's a person who has written widely about Europe and European issues. In the last years, it's become clear that you can't write about Europe without dealing with the question of Islam, the question of multiculturalism, the question of dialogue among cultures. Those questions then lead us to a larger issue, which is actually the bigger issue
that Necla Kelek's book raises. Her book is about a specific subject, about Turkish and Muslim women in Germany. But it's also, by implication, about a much bigger subject, which is cultural integration, tolerance, multiculturalism. What is its value and what are its limits? These are issues that Peter Schneider has thought about a great deal. And it's really a thrill for me to be able to introduce to you one of the leading experts on American-European relations, on European culture, and one of the primary thinkers about this great question the world is now dealing with, which is, where is Europe going? Peter Schneider.
Thank you very much for this kind introduction, Stephen. Well, you have heard that I devoted some of my work to the wall in Berlin and the unification thereafter. And it's only recently that I started to study a new wall building up in the middle of Berlin, an invisible wall. And it has to do with the majority society in Berlin and Muslim immigrants. If you want to approach this wall, you don't just need to go to the east as far as we did in order to reach East Germany or East Berlin. It's actually, we are talking three districts, which now are in the middle of Berlin, the unified Berlin, Neukölln, Wedding, and Kreuzberg. So you see that I'm interested in a more local, regional approach. It's about my home city, Berlin, and the parallel society that is building up. By the way, this will be of some interest, maybe later in the discussion. We are talking about a phenomenon that is a rather recent phenomenon. We have an immigration that is going back to the late 50s, early 60s, but the parallel society is at most only 20 years old. You might remember that, or you have never heard of it, that on the afternoon of September 11, 2001, when the first TV images of the attack on the World Trade Center reached Berlin, I don't want to call, I just want to see the time, hundreds of Berliners gathered in front of the U.S. Embassy in a show of solidarity with the victims. Our chancellor then was expressing what he said, the unconditional solidarity of the German people with the Americans. Since then, I must say, the solidarity has become more conditional. Parallel to these declarations of the majority society, however, rallies of another sort were taking place in the predominantly Muslim districts in the east and center of the city. Bottle rockets, normally seen only on New Year's Eve, were being set off from the courtyards of buildings in the Berlin districts of Kreuzberg and Neukölln. But this was not the usual European display for ringing in the new year. This was a poor man's fireworks, sporadic, sparse, and joyful. Two rockets here, three rockets there. Still altogether, hundreds of rockets were shooting skyward in celebration of the attack, just as the vast majority of Berliners was searching for words to express their horror. By the way, this little incident was hardly reported in the local press. I only found out about it when I did my research right now, some months ago. In the weeks following September 11, rumors and isolated articles in the regional press gave cause for further concern, with reports of cheers and spontaneous dances of joy behind the closed windows of apartments and restaurants scattered through Neukölln and Kreuzberg. School teachers in those districts reported that Muslim pupils remained seated when the class was asked to stand for a moment of silence on the grounds, that they were never asked for a moment of silence when, I quote, Israelis committed a massacre on Palestinians. The sudden interest in their Muslim neighbors' religion and culture that was raised by these phenomenons led to a brief spike in demand for specialists and corresponding upsurge in the number of special broadcasts. For a few weeks, there it was hard to get your hands on a German Koran. You say Koran or Koran? Koran. But that curiosity was soon displaced by the police report on Mohammed Atta's Hamburg cell, which had contributed 4 pilots to the attack of September 11. Questions about the perpetrator's cultural milieu and the general relationship of Muslim immigrants to democracy and Western lifestyle were quickly forgotten. Then in spring 2005, something happened to move these issues back onto the front page. This time it was not mass murder by suicide attackers, but a series of individual killings of Muslims by Muslims. In quick succession, 6 so-called honor killings were committed against young Muslim women, 5 of them in Berlin. The most spectacular case was the murder of Hatun Sürücü. During the night of February 7, 2005, the 20-year-old woman was killed at a bus stop in the Berlin district of Tempelhof, which is close to Kreuzberg, by several shots to Neukölln, is actually closer to Neukölln, by several shots to the head and upper body, fired at point-blank range. The investigation revealed that months before, the victim had reported one of her brothers to the police for threatening her. Now Hatun Sürücü's 3 brothers are under investigation for murder. According to the prosecutor, the oldest brother, 25, acquired the weapon. The middle brother, 24, lured his sister to the scene of the crime in Tempelhof. And the youngest brother, 18, committed the actual murder. The trial has just begun in Berlin. And the youngest brother, as every expert expected, confessed to the murder. According to lawyer Zahran Ateş, herself of Turkish descent, it is generally the youngest who are chosen by the family council to carry out such murders. German juvenile law sets a maximum sentence of 10 years imprisonment for murder, and the offender has the prospect of being released after serving 2/3 of the sentence. Hatun Sürücü grew up in Berlin as the daughter of Turkish Kurds. When she finished 8th grade, her parents took her out of school. Shortly after that, she was taken to Turkey and married to a cousin. Later, she separated from her husband and returned to Berlin pregnant. At the age of 17, she gave birth to her son, Khan. She moved into a mother-child home, a social institution in Berlin, and completed her middle school certificate after the fact, and within 3 years managed to finish a vocational training program as an electrician. The young mother, who had escaped her family's constraints, began to enjoy her newfound freedom and changed her overall lifestyle. She put on makeup, wore her hair open, visited discotheques, and adorned herself with rings, necklaces, and bracelets. Then, just days before receiving her journeyman's diploma, her life was cut short by the fatal shots. It's possible that the archaic family drama that led to the murder of Hatun Sürücü never would have made the headlines at all if it weren't for another piece of news that stirred up the press. Just a few hundred meters away from where Hatun Sürücü was killed, at the Thomas Moore High School, 3 students of Turkish background openly declared their approval of the murder. Shortly before that, same students had bullied a fellow pupil because her clothing was not in keeping with the religious regulations. Volker Steffens, the school's principal, decided to make the matter public in a letter to students, parents, and teachers. More than anything else, it was the students' open condoning of the murder that made the crime against Hatun Türeci the talk of the town and soon of the entire nation. Suddenly, Berlin had its own Theo van Gogh case. After 40 years of neglect, the national policy of integration and immigration were in the center of the public eye. I cut here. One thing is very interesting, that 2 weeks later, 150 people gathered in a silent vigil on behalf of the victim. But these were all organized by a German Berliner organization, not by any Turkish organization. And when I asked one of the heads of one of the great, biggest Turkish mosques why they didn't act and react to this nationwide, this debated murder, they said demonstration and vigils would be no means to react, and the only means to deal with it would be education in the mosque. Okay, there's a problem here. As a Turkish writer, Aras Ören, who has been living in Berlin for 40 years, told me about, and this is many years ago, told me about one of his first plane trips from Istanbul to Berlin. He was sitting next to a farmer from Anatolia who had evidently never been in an airplane before. The man had no idea what to make of the seatbelt, the overhead warning lights, the tray table, nor did he understand his neighbor's explanations. When Aras Ören saw him sitting there in his sandals with his cap on his head and his prayer beads between his thick fingers, he was suddenly overwhelmed by the feeling that his fellow countryman was enclosed in a time capsule. He wasn't going to leave, even after he had landed in Berlin. It made no difference whether the man was traveling to Istanbul or to Berlin. This farmer had never seen a city. He was living in the 18th or 19th century and would carry the customs and rights of his homeland with him to his living room in Berlin. And he would cling to them doggedly if the Western democracy where he was living and working did not make a determined effort to acquaint him with its rules and laws. For decades, Aras Ören has been preaching that it's never been so much a question of multicultural sensitivity as of turning peasants into dwellers and citizens. Now, I would have to explain a little bit the history of the German, of the immigration of Muslim immigrants into Germany. As you might know, after World War II, Germany was in need of many workers, of cheap labor, and we made campaigns all over Europe, especially in the southern Mediterranean countries, way down to Morocco, to get those workers. They were called, and the word says everything, they were called guest workers, and you expect guests to leave at a certain point. Of course, so this is why all the, especially the Christ Democratic chancellors and governments never developed an immigration policy. There was no training whatsoever, for instance, to teach these workers German, to make them acquainted with the basic rules of a democratic society of a Western style. And this went on up to the victory of the green-red government in 1998. This was the first government to develop, who actually said, we are an immigrant country. It was denied by the CDU to recent years. It was totally denied that we are an immigrant country, and this in a situation where we had already 7 million foreigners, and every third or fourth kid in our country now is coming from a mixed marriage. So it was just a total refusal and denial of reality, which cost a price, of course. But now the really interesting thing is, by the way, Max Frisch, the great Swiss writer, he very early on understood the contradiction of this German policy towards the immigrants, and he said, we had invited guest workers, and what we got were human beings, were real people. But these were people who wanted to have a better future for their kids. They wanted to be united with their families, and they wanted to stay. They didn't want to fulfill the notion of the guest worker. They wanted to stay. And the strange thing, I cannot really explain it here, it would take too much time, that the Islamization of the so-called guest workers began only when they started to unify with their families. With their families, Islam migrated to German cities. With the families, the mosque came, the old rites and rules of a rural tradition, mostly of Anatolia, were introduced into the big cities and small cities of Germany. The growing unemployment in Germany, right now it's 4.7 million, over 11% of the workforce, hit the Muslims, immigrants, doubly and triply hard, especially the youth, who had frequently dropped out of school before obtaining a diploma. 70% of the newcomers, according to Minister Otto Schily, landed on welfare the day of their arrival. 70%. Whole enclaves sprang up, consisting of extended families living on the dole. Those with no work and no future were looked after by the mosque, which increasingly became the most important place of communication. Inside the apartments, women resumed their traditional ways, apart from the unclean, who ate pork, drank beer, and let their daughters go to parties and discotheques. Underage Turkish girls were taken out of German schools, brought to Turkey and married off there, while Turkish men in Germany were provided with brides imported from back home. Amidst the German refrigerators, televisions, and mobile phones, an archaic rural culture was celebrating its resurrection, where Turkish was spoken, where people ate, prayed, fasted, and celebrated according to custom, and where the surrounding local culture of unbelievers and unclean was not infrequently looked down upon with contempt. It wasn't until very recently that a broader German public began concerning itself with a parallel Muslim world arising in their midst. And when they did it, it was primarily thanks to three female authors, three rebellious Muslim musketeers. One is sitting here next to me. Their name is Sayran Ateş, Nikla Kelec, and Serap Çileli. About the same age, all three grew up in Germany. They speak German better than many Germans, are educated, successful, and highly articulate. But they each had to risk life and limb for their freedom. Two of them narrowly escaped Hatun Türeci's fate. Beginning with their own experience, the three women describe the vita dolorosa of Muslim women in that model Western democracy known as Germany. Reading these books brought to mind some long-forgotten scenes from 7 years ago. Every time my then 14-year-old daughter invited her schoolmates for a sleepover, the Muslim fathers would be standing at the door at 10 o'clock the evening to pick up their daughters. My wife, an immigrant herself, was indignant. I didn't like these fathers' dismissive, almost threatening posture either, but I was a long way from protesting. Nor did I get excited when my daughter told me that one of the other girls in her class was not taking biology or physical education and no longer going on field trips. For a German of my generation, one of the most holy lessons of the past was the law of tolerance. We Germans in particular had no right to force our highly questionable customs onto other cultures. Later I learned from occasional newspaper reports and the accounts of friends that certain Muslim girls in Kreuzberg and Neukölln went underground or vanished without trace. The books of the three Muslim dissidents now tell us what enlightened Germans, quote, quotation marks, like myself, didn't and didn't want to know. What they report seems just unbelievable. They describe an everyday life of oppression, isolation, imprisonment, and brutal physical punishment for Muslim women and girls in Germany, a situation for which there is only one word, slavery. The lawyer Sayran Atish estimated that at least 5,000 young Turkish women living in Germany are forced into marriage every year, 5,000. In the wake of these forced marriages, often come violence and rape. The bride has no choice but to fulfill the duties of the marriage arranged by her parents and her in-laws. Okay. This is now perhaps the biggest provocation of the three female Muslim rebels, a frontal assault on the moral relativism of the German majority society. In fact, they are fighting on two fronts, one against the Islamic tradition of oppressing women and its proponents, and one against the guilt-ridden tolerance of left-liberal multiculturalists. Before I can get to the Islamic patriarchs, I first have to work my way through these mountains of German guilt, complains Sayran Atish. I consider it an encouraging sign that Muslim residents of Germany are forcefully calling on Germans to defend our democratic achievements against Muslim traditionalists and fanatics who incite hatred of democracy under the banner of respect for cultural difference. But the Germans aren't the only ones who must come to terms with this. The entire West will have to re-examine the rationale behind their policies of integration. The first condition for that is an admission that seems to contradict political correctness. Not all immigrant groups can be integrated equally well. At least the European countries can no longer deny that the integration of Muslim immigrants poses special problems. Moreover, the most recent attacks in the relatively liberal societies of Holland and Great Britain show that while granting civil rights is certainly a necessary step, it is by no means a guarantee for the cultural integration of Muslim immigrants. A Muslim of the third or fourth immigrant generation can possess a German, English, or Dutch passport, speak the local language fluently, and still remain a foreigner or even become a mortal enemy. The crucial thing is whether he accepts the basic tenets of democracy. And there's a third thing. Democracies can no longer shut their eyes to the fact that religious convictions are a main barrier to integration for many Muslims. The assertion that radical Islamic fundamentalism, the oppression of women, and Islam itself have nothing to do with one another is close to the assertion that there was no link between Stalinism and communism. The fact is that the disregard for women's rights, and especially the right for sexual self-determination, is an integral component of almost all Islamic societies, including those in the West. Until this issue is somehow solved with the corresponding reform of Islam as practiced in the West, there will never be a successful acculturation. as long as the West relies mostly on religious institutions, our religious institutions, to import or impart their system of values, they are asking something impossible of the Muslims, namely the readiness to convert. Only by sticking to the separation of religion and state can the Western democracies convince their Muslim residents that human rights are universally valid and not bound to one confession. We Western women, says Sayran Atish, will set off the reform of traditional Islam because we are its victims.
Well, this was really a fascinating discussion. I can only suggest that maybe the ultimate solution might be based on an episode that Chancellor Helmut Kohl sent his son to go to school here at MIT, and one day he shows up back in Dad's house and says, by the way, I've decided to marry a Turkish girl. So maybe we can start with that.
You've been listening to a panel discussion presented by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University in cooperation with the Goethe Institute Boston and the American Council on Germany. Tonight's discussion was titled Being Muslim in Germany Today and featured authors Neshla Kalek and Peter Schneider. Our moderator was New York Times correspondent Steve Kinzer. We began with an introduction by Institute Executive Director Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skov with help from Michael Garth. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.